If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
It's a post-PRGE CU podcast, post-Pat having a good voice as well, for Tuesday, October 22nd, 2019, alongside Ian Ferguson.
Hello, howdy.
I'm on its deathbed, Pat Contry. We're talking about a new Star Wars trailer. Analog Pocket announced, Internet Archive adding DOS games, IGN top 100 list, it's a doozy, and more in your Q&A. Ian, wondrous time at PRGE this year.
Yes.
It's the heartbeat of the retro gaming scene, we always say, correct?
Yes.
And the heartbeat of America.
It's true. It's a good place to go and kind of get an idea as to what's going on in the collecting scene, and also just in terms of what's, you know, popular at any given moment when it comes to, you know, who's playing what with retro games. It's always interesting to see, you know, how many people are at the arcades or how many people take interest in the pinball or, say, the living room setups, and, you know, what more or less seems to be on the tables in large amounts in the vendor area.
Yeah, what are the vendors, or what are they peddling? What people are interested in? What's the demographics at the event?
Right.
You know, things like that. What's the focus? They had the 30-year anniversary Game Boy Museum.
Yep.
Along with some Genesis games from John Hancock, but Frank Keltz did a great job setting up the museum. They also had the Counselor's Corner.
Yes, Nintendo,
that was great.
Was fantastic.
And that was Archon 1981 that brought a lot of that stuff. That the workers used to have.
Yeah, I remember talking to him briefly during Comic-Con when Frank was down here and he was detailing, you know.
That's the first time I met him.
Detailing, going and getting all that stuff. I briefly spoke to him during Comic-Con. But yeah, it was very cool to see that all come together.
And Howard Phillips showed up as well again. Yes. And Howard Phillips is, thankfully, he's going to get more involved with the Video Game History Foundation.
Yeah, he seems excited to, you know, be back doing that sort of stuff.
So the elder statesman we need for this, because there's not many of the old guard out there actively helping, you know, like tell the stories and get the documents. And that's something there, a little fuzzy.
Yeah, a little fuzz. You got it.
A little tissue fuzz. On my. See, that's how sick I am. I don't have time to even shave.
A little linty. A little linty.
A little linty on my. So there's a lot of there was a lot of that fun stuff like that happening. In terms of the auction, I did not go. There was an NWC labelless that was there, and there was an 18,000 reserve, I heard, but didn't get close to that, so it didn't sell. There was one thing I would have bid on. There was a big box 80s and 90s PC lot that went for really cheap. I heard it went for $800, and that included the first four Ultima games, which alone are worth over $800. It even had that first Gabriel Knight with that weird oblong trapezoidal-shaped box in the top bottom, which Metal Jesus said is really hard to find. So for $800, I would have bid more than that. I would have been way more than that, and there was, I'm not even counting, probably like there were 20 games.
Touching back to the NWC real quick, I heard that, I think so. It had an 18,000 reserve.
Yeah.
It went up to, I believe, 16,200 or something like that.
Even that's getting there,
right? Yeah. And it didn't go. And I believe what I heard was the guy actually said, "Okay, 17 right now," and there were no buyers.
So even at 16,200, people were like, "That's a little bit much,"
right? And I was discussing it. What was I discussing it with in the lobby? I don't wanna, I think it was like John Riggs or Jason. But we were sitting around kind of talking about it, and I think with the auction, you can take something that normally goes for like a lower price. Let's say you have item X, and normally item X would go for about $200.
Sure.
You could take it to an auction, especially an auction like PRGE, where it's known to get exciting and things are kind of unpredictable. And you could expect that, yeah, you could reasonably, maybe in the right moment, get that $200 item up to like five or six.
Sure.
But when you're dealing with something as expensive as an NWC, I think some of that excitement, it's already baked into the idea that you're bidding on an NWC. I don't think you're actually going to get much more than the market price for it, because it's an expense.
There's a lot less buyers versus something that's even $1,000.
At this point, it's an expensive enough item where I think the people who are even going to spend that much on it aren't looking to spend a whole lot more.
Sure,
they're not going to get caught up in it. They're going to go, wait a second, you know, if I just hold back, I can get maybe one with a nicer label for, you know, this price or a little bit less than this, you know, when it pops up next online.
Sure. And then in terms of the demographics of the people there. There was definitely a near seismic shift. And it wasn't just me saying that, it was other people, other vendors, in terms of what people were looking for. And I know in the past year we kind of talked about, well, it was surprising to see Earthbound still for sale one year, you said, at the end of the day. This was the year, if you have to say 2019, was the shift forward in terms of like the generational shift of collectors in terms of what they're looking for, by and large. It used to be, you know, Genesis and NES and Super Nintendo, and it was even a lot more, even classic computer stuff, I would say, than this year. And this year, you look on the tables, and you see Amaray cases, and you see DVD-style cases everywhere. You see, tons of Wii games and PS2 games and PS3 games, you know, and 360 and Xbox, and like, you know, post-2000 games, we'll just say, like 2000. And that's what a lot of it was this year.
Yeah, it was. I would say, you know, some of the booths that have been there forever that used to come, and half their, you know, mega booths were NES cartridges. I mean,
not anymore.
Barely any to be seen. I think for the first time in a long time, I saw more older stuff, like I saw more Game Boy this year than I had. Not a lot of it good, but I saw lots of Game Boy.
You're on the lookout for that, so you're
a lot more of it, but. Yeah, it's, I mean, I always say retro is whoever's got the money, whoever in adulthood's got the money and is rebuying their childhood, that's what's retro. And right now, I really did see mostly PlayStation 1, N64 on up, lots and lots of PS2, lots and lots of Wii.
My eye just caught the tons of cases because I've just seen those cases.
Yeah.
Because they all blend together in your eye, all the white cases, those whatever bluish black PS3 cases, all the PS2 cases. That's what I noticed.
So to me, it doesn't necessarily, it's not a bad thing. I mean, Portland was just as fun as it always is, if not better. The show is continuously, every year that show gets run, it seems better. And I know a lot of people were nervous about, a lot of the people I talked to were nervous because, you know, they're always nervous about the show they're putting on. But from where I sit, everything was very good, as it always is. I did notice, though, that there was a lot of, there's the Heritage Auction folks and the Go Collect.
Oh, before we get to that real quick, okay. I want to follow up on the Nintendo stuff. In terms of the volume I saw, it was more limited in terms of games I saw. Correct. Gone are the days where... at least at this event, there was not many sellers. I don't notice any of that. Like, sometimes there'd be a seller that have almost like a vast majority of the NES library in cart form for sale.
Yes.
You go see like one vendor would have like 600 NES games, correct?
Yeah.
Like, they'd have like them just lined up. And I went to one vendor, I believe it was Double Jump, and they had their little, you know, top glass display of like, you know, 200 plus NES games. Like you know, your Bubble Bobble 2s, your things like that. And I straight up asked him on Sunday, how are these doing? He said, they're not moving. You know, they're just not. And they haven't. And I'm just like, well, it's something we talk about where, you know, not only did prices peak a few years ago, but the interest has peaked because it was a combination of people already, majority of people, like I said, the collectors already have what they want. Mm-hmm. They've had 10 years to get it, or even you want to say 5-6 years to acquire it. And then combine that with the numbers getting pumped up to an extreme where if you have a moderate interest, now wait. I don't need to spend $350 or $400 on Power Blade 2 or whatever that even costs even more. I'll wait on a Bubble Bobble 2. I don't need to buy it that badly. I mean, it's $50, I'll buy it, but I'm not going to spend $300
sure.
on it. And that's the weird point we're at now. That's what the bubble is when you have all this inventory on hand to sell them and people don't want to buy it anymore. So there was also, though, Ian, less kitschy little toy items because those are like usually the older sellers, the sellers that were like kids, say, in the 70s and early 80s. So
there was one booth with like some of the older board games, but even then
used to be a lot more than that.
Yeah, it used to be a lot more, and even then, like the shift in the era of the games and stuff had kind of moved up. I mean, after a while,
the toys and things, the things that I always come back, with a little toy or not really many handhelds. I saw I made two vendors with like a limited amount of handhelds. Our friend Charles, who usually sells it, or it's not selling anymore. So that's a big, like, not seeing him sell there was like, oh, because every year I buy something from him. Every year. Sure. I buy at least something. One year I bought like 60 handhelds. Not even joking how many handhelds I bought. So there's definitely been a shift in the sellers. Demographically, slightly too. You're always going to have a nice mix, though, but there has been a shift there in the audience. Now, you want to speak about the Heritage and WADA folks?
So what I just want to say, the Heritage and WADA folks...
and Go Collect.
And Go Collect.
Responsibly.
We're all there. And I saw the WADA booth seemed like it had interest. I mean, that... graded collecting of everything is, I think, going to be around, but I didn't see a whole lot of people necessarily around Heritage or Go Collect. This is neither here nor there. This is not a knock against them, but I don't know if the convention floor in Portland is necessarily, with the shift that's going on, it seemed like it might not have been the best timing for Heritage or Go Collect to pop in, because I don't know that their market is anymore.
That's not the clientele.
The market's not there anymore.
A 25-year-old kid looking for PS2 games is not the clientele for sealed games.
Right.
Those are the top 1%. Now, there were people going around Friday buying every sealed game they can to get them graded eventually. And
right.
You know, and to hoard them and things like that. I mean, we know these people now. I know two in particular that were there, including our friend Danielle was there.
I've never met her. So
well, she should have been.
She's your friend, Danielle.
You should have been.
I can't judge her one way or another.
You should have been. Well, if I can tell a story, you should have been there on Friday during the setup, because during the setup of the booth where I'm signing certain guidebooks, she came over with the crowd. Not a crowd. There was like one person with her 10 feet away. Bobby was there. Bobby was laughing while I'm literally unboxed with signs. She goes, she basically just, I don't want to say laid into me, but she was yelling at me, and she was trying to get back at me for my analysis of the Chris Kohler article about the gold NES Goldmine Rush. And she said, oh, well, I got to make some counterpoints to you. I'm like, well, no, I made the counterpoints to your points in the article where there were no counterpoints. You know, that's how it worked. It's always funny when people say, bring me on your podcast. It's like every other week now. And then it came down to, I said, listen, Danielle. And I like Danielle. I like her. She's feisty. I like her. I said, listen, I didn't take any personal shots at you, but I said it came off incredibly arrogant how you were saying how these sellers don't know what they're selling. The same thing I said in the response, when their clientele doesn't, you know, they don't care. Those big game sellers don't care about the bros being on the left or right, because they're not making money off of that.
We do know about that. I've known about that forever. But we've never charged more for it.
Exactly.
No one would buy it.
So it's incredibly arrogant to say these vendors that sellers have been doing for 20 years don't know what they're talking about. And she said, well, they don't know what they're talking about. I said, see, that's the problem. You can't say that to these people. It's arrogant. And then she finally said, yeah, I can be arrogant. I'm like, well, there you go. If you're admitting yourself, then I didn't say anything wrong. I really did. I told her I loved her. And I didn't see her the rest. I don't think I saw the rest of the weekend there. But it was funny because in the middle of yelling at me, she looked around. Do you have any games for sale? So she was still in that mode of buying the games. I just thought it was funny.
Collector's going to collect.
If you want to say collector, investor, yes, they're going to do that. So that was fun. Oh, it's the PRG. Our panel went well. See, a podcast panel. Even my voice was like, you think it's bad now? It was like 10 times worse. I was talking like this the whole time. That was fine.
Want to mention, I'll briefly mention two things here. They're kind of related. Greatest thing in the world you ever showed me on the convention floor. I have to talk about it just because it was... This is a game that I've wanted my entire life and
basketball
never
classics.
Knew it existed. So, basketball classics. So it's we found that on the floor. It's
an indie game.
It's an 8-bit style basketball game. Basically, from what I can tell, the idea was they wanted to take Tecmo basketball but make it good.
So basically, like the Tecmo Super Bowl style of game, but transfer that into. Because I don't think Tecmo actually worked on Tecmo NBA Basketball. I got to look at the developer. But it doesn't seem like a Tecmo-style game compared to Tecmo Bowl and Tecmo. You know what I mean? Like, it's just different.
So the game is wild. It has, like, I went over and I saw it and I lost my mind.
Well, I pointed out that you like ran over.
Yeah, I
and it was only like 25, 30 feet away from us. We didn't see it on Saturday.
So anyways, they I'm looking at them and I play the demo. And it's fun. And basically, the game, you know, you can, like, choose a play like a pick and roll by like running down that lane on the first half of it if you want to.
That's
or you don't, and like you'll see like the meter charge up, and then that's the, it initiates that play, so it'll send the.
Oh, you can do a meter charge to send it.
Well, so I'll have to explain it to you better. I'll be streaming this tonight if I'm not dead. But you know, it's simple three button gameplay: pass, block, jump, shoot, and. It's got over 900 players in it.
With stats.
So basically, there's when you go to load up, just say like a quick game, you go back and forth between. There's a year on the side, and you can change the year, and then you can pick different teams from each year. Some years it has everyone. Some years it just has you know, like the playoff teams, but they're constantly adding new rosters.
Sure.
And then it's crazy because like you can pick a certain year and a certain team, and like the star players will be wearing the right colored shoes and stuff like that.
But they're small little techno bowl style guys. So
but
it's
really detailed for what it is.
There's a story mode.
So
there's tournament season.
I started playing the story mode. I got to tell you a little bit about the story mode last night. Real quick. I'll talk more about the game later, but the story mode, you start off, you like steal a basketball, and then a giant floating head comes and talks to you. And you play on a team that's called the, it's killing me, like the Slugs or something. Like, or it's like a name for like a bad team. And you have to assemble a new team, and it's like you're in a dream state, and you have to like recruit players like Bird and Jordan onto your team, and by doing so you play a match against them on the team from their best year, so you're playing against like their all-star versions, and then you recruit it's nuts. I wish I could say more about it. I played it for like 2 hours last night. I'm too tired to talk comprehensively.
Okay. And there's also like cut scenes, the dynamic dunk cutaway system, things like that, and so tip off stuff.
Certain dunks are more like a mini game where like you'll go up and you have to kind of like position the ball. You have to position the ball and time it properly so that it gets past the defender.
And there's a YouTuber team that's unlockable.
Yes.
Without our approval.
I don't care. It's approved. I don't care.
I am the point guard, and Ian is the small forward on this YouTuber unlockable team.
Yes.
With stats. Now, I will update my stats. They're incorrect. I'm in the game. I saw the stat. My stats grand picture. Every a player has like a close-up picture of themselves. Like in the selection. So the artist, this is two guys, Namo Gamo Games, two guys did this. This is their first game. The artist drew 900 faces.
Yeah.
For legendary players and assholes like us. So I'm going to tell my new stats and update them because my rebounding, my offense is way too high, but my defense and defense is too low. So we're going
to
swap that.
I need to double check mine. I need to make sure my stats are garbage. I would like to be represented. I'd like to be represented realistically. And the soundtrack is phenomenal and very weird. All
right, so check it out. It's on Steam. It's called Basketball Classics.
I bought a little disc from them with a scratch off code. It was a nice way to sell it. It looked like a 3.25 floppy.
It's only, I think it's $9.99. Check it out there, and it's getting good reviews on Steam so far. So moving on. Ian.
Pat.
Star Wars. Trending number one right now. Do you want to watch the trailer? We'll discuss it.
Let's do it. I've never seen it.
You've never seen Star Wars ever?
Ever. Not one. Not a Star Wars.
Did you see the new ones at all?
I did. I liked them.
You saw Last Jedi?
I liked Last Jedi better than Force Awakens.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Okay, let's play this. Is the volume up here?
I didn't think it was an amazing movie, but it was fine. It was a Star War.
It was a Star War?
It's an instinct.
Closed captions on?
A feeling. The Force brought us together. We're not alone.
That was Lando.
We will fight if we lead them.
The Vulture.
People keep telling me they know me. No one does.
But I do.
Wet Kylo.
Kylo wet.
Long have I waited. And now you're coming together. doing?
What are you doing there, 3PO?
Taking one last look, sir. At my friends.
Aww. You rolled your eyes. Good shot.
Confronting fear is the destiny of a Jedi. Your destiny.
Horses?
Ooh, a B-wing I saw.
Yeah.
Whoa.
The Force will be with you.
Always.
Boom, boom, boom. Bum, bum, bum. The last Star Wars movie with, well, at least in that galaxy, they're going to do more Star Wars movies, but it's not going to be Skywalker or Rebel Alliance versus the Empire. Ian, are you excited for Star Wars?
I mean, in the way that I'm excited for every Star Wars movie, which is that I will watch it. Yeah. I didn't see Force Awakens, Rise of the Jedi,
in theaters,
Return of the Jedi. What the fuck was the second one?
Last Jedi. Did you see the last movie?
I didn't see that one in theaters. I finally did watch it. I think I mentioned on the podcast. I watched it about 6 months ago, and I was like, "Hey, this is a fine movie. It's okay. It's fine. I have no fucking.
It's not a classic.
I have no issues with it.
It's not the worst movie ever.
It's hard for me with Star Wars. I think to expect anything more than it was cool.
Here's the thing.
But I like the characters they've introduced in this movie. I like Finn. I like Rey. I like Poe. I like them. I would like to see how it finishes. The Kylo Ren stuff. I like it. I hope more than anything I watch a trailer like this, and I just hope to God that the fans are fucking happy in some way, shape, or form, because I don't want to goddamn hear it after this movie. That's what I'm burned out on.
I'm not burned out. I'm sort of tired. And what this trilogy has done, you can say the prequel trilogy didn't do this as much. This third trilogy has exposed just how thin this universe is in terms of what you can do with it. I mean, it's still the same.
Right.
Evil Empire versus ragtag group with lightsabers all the fucking time and ship battles. I mean, I understand that's what Star Wars is built upon, but how many movies can you do until enough? We've seen the same story again.
Yeah, I'm not arguing that stuff's bad, because it's not bad at all. It's fun, but we don't...
It has to end. Though at some point, me it has to.
Oh yeah, it does.
And I'm a huge Star Wars. I collected the toys.
I looked at that trailer, and I'm more interested in that. Than
I'm interested
I was in.
I want to see how it ends. I want to see how they retcon some. They claim they're not retconning some stuff from Last Jedi. Oh yes, they are. You only see Rose on screen in the trailer for like a second, and she was a semi important character in Last Jedi. And obviously the Emperor thing has come out of nowhere for this third movie. And people are like, oh, this is cool. We'll get the Emperor back because he's an awesome character. And we killed off the other guy in the middle of the movie, anticlimactically. Snopes, or whatever the hell his name is. Snoke. Snopes is the website. Big space battle, check. Forest, check. Lando, check. Emperor, check. It's Return of the Jedi. So every movie has been a retread in some form of the original trilogy.
Yes.
It has been elements. The end of Last Jedi was Hoth, except it wasn't ice, it was sand. They haven't been able to... That's the one thing about Lucas, is that Lucas, even though he went too far in some places, as he admits, he at least went radically off the rails in the prequels to do something that we really didn't see before in the original trilogy.
Yeah.
He failed because it was too far, but this is overly familiar to me versus... That was radically weird with stuff like Jar Jar that totally missed the mark.
Yeah, it hits too many familiar beats, and even just looking at that trailer, I go, "Oh, this is the Return of the Jedi."
Yeah. We're gonna have a big ship battle while Rey faces the Emperor. You know what I mean? So I'm excited, but I've seen the people saying, oh, I'm crying over it. So I'm just like, I wish I still had that sort of in my heart. I just don't anymore.
Well, and
it's going to be fun. And J.J. Abrams is a good director.
I have to say, I think no differently about someone who is like that. I wish I still felt that way about some movie or something like that. Like, I get it. I just, it's not doing it for me. It hits the beats. It's trying to tug on the heartstrings. It's fine, but it is doing it in the, I think, the most obvious way.
It's Return of the Jedi 2 to me.
Luckily, Return of the Jedi was my favorite of the original trilogy, so hopefully this will be my favorite of this one.
It wasn't mine, but it wasn't a bad movie. It just didn't stack up with the other ones, right, at least to me, because I hated the idea of having a second Death Star, and obviously the Ewoks to me was weak, and that was a marketing move, and it was like, well, we didn't see any Ewoks in here. Cross your fingers, maybe they'll come back. Now, if the Ewoks come back, all bets are off. I'm gonna trash this movie if there's Ewoks. If they somehow fit Endor into this,
I want a fucking Ewok.
You want a fucking Ewok?
You want to clarify
that statement?
I want a fucking Ewok in the movie. You know, I'm just gonna drop the expletive. I would like to see an Ewok in the movie.
There goes our analytic. There goes suppressing our video because the cursing and the ads. I mean, that's a thing. But whatever, it's Ewoks. Yeah, I think that'd be exciting. I want to see what ends up. It's supposed to be the longest movie out of all the Star Wars. It's like 2 hours 35 minutes. The Last Jedi was over 2.5 hours. That was way long. But this is going to tie it up. The one thing I'll say about this character is I really think they dropped the ball in two ways. They've had a lightsaber battle in all the movies between Kylo and Rey, which they should have waited, I think, at least for that. So it's like, but at this point, it's like the third or fourth time they're having a lightsaber battle. It's like, it just doesn't feel the same way as, you know, you waited until Empire or Luke got his ass kicked at least at the end of the second movie because he was undertrained. In this movie, they sort of were even in the first movie. And then the second movie, Rey gets more powerful, and she's more powerful. Mary Sue, et cetera, et cetera, if you want to go down that path.
No.
The first time I heard the term Mary Sue. But I think they really dropped the ball with Finn in particular. Finn really didn't do that much in the second movie when you think about it.
No.
Poe didn't do that much in the first movie.
No.
Poe disappeared for the middle, like, hour of that movie. So that's what I mean about they don't have the built-in camaraderie that Leia, Han, and Luke did, because they were always palling around together in the first movie, and then there always were groups of them in the second and the third. Yes, I guess we really haven't had that experience with these three characters where they're together for a chunk of a movie.
Right.
And I think that's been to the detriment. I don't think these characters...
I think that could be to the positive of this movie, though. That's what I think.
Well, they're finally together?
I'm hoping that's what the payoff is. You know, you get to see them together.
But you want to see them together to build up the familiarity.
No, I get it.
I don't see in the future... I just don't see the love for these three characters as the original three. I don't think you would have saw it anyway, but they haven't earned it. They haven't been like... those interactions between the three of them. Like, I mean, hell. The interaction... In the Death Star trash compactor scene is brilliant between the three of them. It almost sounds semi-ad-libbed some of the lines.
Yeah.
And that sort of chemistry you had not seen to that extent with these three characters in this, because they haven't been together. So hopefully that's a thing going forward. So like I said, I'll be there. Maybe not opening day, but, you know, because the tickets sold out quicker than Endgame, supposedly. They sold out a ton more of them. But I'll be there sometime during the weekend. You know, we'll go at a midnight showing over here. You know, hopefully not the second room.
Yeah, I'll go see it. Like I said, I didn't see Last Jedi in theaters. And I do like, I mean...
I love space battles.
Oh, I was going to say, I love being surrounded by lasers and whooshing spaceships. So, I mean, I don't want people to think I'm overly negative on this. In fact, my lack of enthusiasm is more just like... It's more of a, it's going to be fine. It's going to be bad. It's going to be fine.
I just wish that, in retrospect, I think a lot of people years from now be like, what could have been if they actually did like the Admiral Thrawn trilogy or something that was well established that you had, you know, people loved like 20 years ago that you could have drawn upon more for something totally different. I mean, obviously, they didn't use any Lucas's ideas. By the way, shout out to our friend Yoshi, who worked on the Death Star. So, like, when you see him fight on the Death Star and all the
images,
that's Yoshi plugging away in a CG station doing that. Good job, my friend, Yosh. All right, moving on. Everyone's got a cell phone nowadays, Ian. But if you're still using one of those big wireless providers in 2019, you have to ask yourself, why? Why? You're paying for expensive retail stores, inflated prices, hidden fees. You might be being taken advantage of. Enter Our pals at Mint Mobile. Mint Mobile provides the same premium network coverage you're used to, but at a fraction of the cost because everything is done online. Less overhead. They save on retail locations and then pass those savings to you. Mint Mobile makes it easy to cut your wireless bill down to just $15 a month, and that's with unlimited nationwide talk and text. And you can stop paying for unlimited data you'll never use because you can choose between plans with 3, 8, or 12 gigabytes of 4G LTE data. I don't know anyone who needs 12 gigabytes, but hey, you might. You know, if you're an Uber driver or constantly streaming movies, maybe you need that. Here's the best part, Ian. You get to keep your own phone with Mint Mobile and your own number. As long as you own your phone and it's unlocked and it's a GSM phone, you can just transfer to Mint Mobile. They'll ship you a nice little kit with a little SIM card with different sizes that you clip off and you put in your phone. And you get the little app and you're up and running in like 15 minutes. It's great. I have it. I use it. And they use the T-Mobile network. It's a legit nationwide network, so you won't get those dropped calls that are frisky. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/CU podcast. That's mintmobile.com/CU podcast and cut your wireless bill to $15 a month today. All right, Ian, we were at Portland Retro Gaming Expo.
Is it time for a little magic?
We had a panel. A lot of magic because Ian's Analog Pocket was announced.
That's right.
And he's happy, so Ian's going to talk about it here.
Woo.
Exciting times the past week. Of course, just like a year ago, we discussed a new announcement by Analog literally at Portland last year for the Super NT.
No, for the Mega SG.
Was it Mega SG a year ago?
Mega SG was a year ago.
2 years ago was Super NT.
Correct.
So once a year, they're coming on board. Ian, they just announced the Analog Pocket.
So at the end of the... Yeah. So at the end of... I don't know if they can hear you. I hope they can. I hope they can hear the enthusiasm. So at the end of the last podcast, we mentioned that they were going to be making an announcement about a system on Wednesday, and we were hoping that we would be talking about it this weekend. And I went off, like, my brain started spiraling out of control. And I started thinking about all the things it could be. And I was like, boy, howdy, it would be great if it was a portable system that could do Neo Geo Pocket Color and Game Gear and all those things. And I woke up the next morning and had to go to the bathroom.
Is your brain dialect really say boy howdy to yourself?
I say boy howdy to myself and other people all the time.
You have an old-timey personality, I guess.
Yeah.
Internal narration going on.
Yeah, it's not okay upstairs. So yeah, they announced it, and it's going to be called the Analog Pocket. It's going to be $199. It comes out sometime next year. It's going to do Game Boy, Game Boy Color, and Game Boy Advance out of the box. And with adapters, it will do Game Gear, Neo Geo Pocket Color, and Lynx.
And more, it says.
There's no mention of WonderSwan, but I'm wondering if that's because they're trying to keep the marketing on brand to stuff that was released in the United States.
Systems people actually played here, yes.
Because, yeah, the WonderSwan never came out here. So with the they've added a second FPGA board, which will allow third-party development. So hobbyists, whoever wants to, can develop new cores. And then ostensibly, if there was an adapter made for it, I would think it would probably be able to do WonderSwan fine, I would hope.
From the magic mind of Kevtris, so programming all these cores, we think. It probably is. So this is a description. A multi-video game system, portable handheld, a digital audio workstation.
Yeah, I'll get into that in a second.
Built-in synthesizer and sequencer, a tribute to portable gaming. Look at that. Look at that, Ian. Completely engineered in two FPGAs. It's beautiful. And there's a black version and a white version.
Yes. So just like every system they've done so far, well, they did it with the Genesis, and they did it with the... Did they do it with the Super Analog? Was there a pack-in on that?
Well, the NT had the... which one had the running gun shooter? Was that the Genesis one?
Yes. Anyways, so that was the Genesis one. I'm trying to remember if there was one on the Super Nintendo.
I don't remember. Oh, Turrican 2 was Super.
Okay, that's right. It was
what did the Mega SG have with it?
Hardcore.
That's right. Okay.
So they're including something on this one that I think is very unique and very fitting of the system that they're making. So what they're including with the Analog Pocket is a program called NanoLoop. NanoLoop's been around for a long time. It's up there with LSDJ as one of the two
I would say, main programs people use for composing chiptunes on the Game Boy. I think the Game Boy at this point is a lot of people, or at least I do, associate it with music production. All of the neat mods that have come out recently in the past, you know, decade for Game Boys, the backlights, the new shells, the fancy silicon buttons, it's all kind of been based around the people who use these systems for chip tuning. So it's very interesting to see them make that nod and include this on there. So instead of a game, you're getting music production software.
Can you explain real quick, like, how would you use that in a setup?
So NanoLoop is it's a sequencer and a synthesizer. So basically you can go in and you can mess with the waveforms, and then you can place them out like you would on a drum machine. The pictures that they show of it actually kind of do a really good job of explaining how it works. And step by step, it will play the notes that you've placed into, basically it's like a piano roll.
It's like a timeline. It's like a timeline you're looking at.
So anyways, I think it's very, they very much understand their market with this. I when we talked about it on the podcast, I did mention, I was like, it would be really neat if it was pro sound and all that. And it looks like it's going to have nice audio output, and it's going to cater towards that sort of market. So, yeah, I'm very excited about that.
Which has helped keep Game Boy alive the past, like, what, say 10, 15 years about,
you know, the chip. It's not just gaming. It's used as an instrument, and they're making a very obvious nod.
Because the audio chip in the Game Boy is more powerful than the NES one. It's more advanced. You can do a little bit more with it.
Yes.
Yeah, but it still has that old-timey 8-bit, you know, feel to it.
Right, I think it's probably what people would think of most when they think of chiptunes.
Yeah, it's a little more complex. You can do a little bit more with that.
So they've also said that next year they're going to be putting a dock out for it. I'm going to guess the dock is going to be 100, but I have no idea. I'm going to base that on the fact that Nintendo gets 80 for their docks
for an
Switch,
HDMI out dock.
And it's yeah. So I have a feeling they'll be able to get a $100 price tag on that, which makes it three.
So we don't know. Then there's no direct HDMI out that we know of then with this.
There isn't.
That's a shame.
With the dock and the additional FPGA board that can be worked on.
Yeah, that's a big one to me.
And the size of it, then you start to think about it and it gets exciting because it's like having a flash cart that you don't need a system for. It's small. It's portable. Yeah. You can put a core for something else on there. And, you know, depending on how they do the adapters, or obviously it's going to be jailbroken and people are going to be using ROMs, you can travel this thing around and use it to play just about anything, I think.
So
like
famously,
the opportunities are really very, there's almost no limit to what you can do with it.
Limit. So famously, starting with the Mini NT, the Mini NT, like they were quote unquote jailbroken almost officially, unofficially, to let other cores be ported onto it, 8-bit cores. So with this, I mean, Kevtris has like what, 10, 12 cores he's done, going back to like the Intellivision and, you know, things like that, and Atari.
Right.
So that's what he was talking about. Like, bring those cores that exist if they're not as they're not more complex, and then you put them on this. Now you have a portable device for multiple systems potentially.
Right. Once that thing can read ROMs, I mean, you can be taking, you know, the PC Engine library around with you. You could take the
Turbo Express.
So,
oh God.
Well, there.
Heart's a flutter.
Don't get your sickness.
Maybe it's the Halls drops.
You're smelling medicated.
No. Did I get drugged by this random person?
So, I'll be honest, I don't love the look of it.
What don't you like about it?
I prefer the wider hold as opposed to the more narrow design. I think the buttons look a little close together. Action buttons.
I really don't like these corner bottom right menu buttons. That's really bad. If you're holding it, I think you can hit it by accident. They should, Alan's going to listen to me, they should recess those buttons. So
right.
Like a reset button on a computer, you have to really dig your finger in to hit it. I think people might hit those buttons by accident.
So as much as this system is kind of like everything I want out of a portable, I don't love the look of it, but really it's not going to matter once it's doing what it's supposed to do,
which is
playing the games.
Are there triggers for Game Boy Advance?
Of course there are.
Where's a picture with them?
They show them. It's where the cartridge goes in.
Oh, that is. Is that an HDMI out on there?
No, that's a link cable.
Oh.
It's a link port. There's your triggers.
Oh, I didn't see them. Oh, so they're like kind of at the bottom where the Game Boy cart would be. So it's not all the way up. It's like in the middle. That's okay. That works.
Yeah, that's fine.
So kind of like SSP-ish in a way.
Yes.
Cool. No, okay. I'm on board. I'm down. If this can If we get a TurboGrafx FPGA core, they throw this on this and have Turbo Express basically in a better way, because this is going to be a much cleaner LCD screen. Is it 3.5 inches or is it 3.5, 615 PPI LCD with a 1600 times 1440 resolution? So that'll get you all the systems up to like modern day you can have on there with that resolution and a small size. That's like overkill for an LCD that size. You know, that's great. 10 times the resolution of an original Game Boy. Yeah, we can hardly believe it either. Pro level color accuracy, dynamic range, and brightness. That's everything, yeah. The brightness can be like through the roof with the modern LCD on here. It's great.
So the question is, what are we going to be talking about next year? I mean, how many more places can they go?
Turbo and PC Engine? That would be naturally next.
Yeah, Turbo and PC Engine. Sure. You're not wrong.
Well,
that is something they could do.
but if it was too complex for developers back then to do an FPGA, sure, that would probably take years and years, you know?
So, I mean, ideally, I think the one that would be that people would want next would be an N64, but I don't think we'll get that next year.
No, I think you'll stay with the 8-bit stuff first, like Turbo, and get that out of the way. Get that whole generation out of the way, then move forward. I'm not sure. Where do the adapters on the Mega SG cost? Like $10 each for a Sega Master System? Is that what they cost?
It comes with it.
It came with it?
Yeah.
Did it come with the card one as well? Or is that separate?
That's separate, and I don't think that's been released yet, which is something that is probably worth bringing up. As neat as these adapters we have to see them first.
Gotcha.
Without them, you're not doing anything.
And with this, you need them to make three. Game Gear, Pocket Color, and Lynx adapters we need.
Correct.
Right? Because the other three can do on its own. Okay, that's, to me, a little problematic just because everyone's going to want all of them just in case. I mean, to me, I love the Lynx, and that thing is gigantic. It's nice to have a little small Lynx I can play Gauntlet and California Games on, or APB. You know, I'm in for a Lynx one for sure. I don't have many NGPC games to use that with. But I think, what are they, $10 each, the adapters? I think that's reasonable. I wish it would come with one of your choice, maybe, if they get them all done ahead of time. That'd be cool. You know?
Yeah, I think we'll be waiting to see them.
You think so?
Yeah.
Well, that's a big seller to me, is getting the extra systems. I mean, that's great. It's 6-in-1. They said plus more, whatever that is. Yeah, this is exciting. Now you can preserve video game history, too. Yeah, 100 years from now, there might just be FPGA systems that still exist that you can play. You know, maybe the hardware and circuitry breaks down on a regular Game Boy, unless, you know, you keep it like in a 60-degree non-humidity room, and it'll still work. Like, who knows? But that's what they're thinking about, too, which is great. So, yeah, I think if they do one a year over the next 10 years and get all these systems going, and who knows how far the technology jumps, or hey, maybe you do a PS1 FPGA at some point, you know, like, that'd be interesting. Sure. We get to that point. But there's a big jump up between 16-bit and then the leap forward to like 32 and 64. It's like, in terms of the complexity to program the FPGA, as far as I know, I'm not an expert, it's like exponentially harder.
So anyone want to see Pat's mouse?
That's been dropping on my hardwood floor
it's
for
real
the past
bad.
Year. Thanks for mouse.
No problem. I'm just upset that this hasn't been fixed.
Thanks for mouse shaming me.
You're welcome.
How am I going to fix it? Glue the pieces back
buy
on?
Buy a new one. That obviously cost $3 10 years ago.
Swap me dollar. You see what I got to put up with? I'm like dying here already. But all right, so is this going to be open pre-orders or limited? I think it's limited, right? Limited on here.
I already signed up for the alert.
What's it cost? $199.99,
and then I'm going to guess $100 for the dock next year.
That's a little. They got to bring that price down on the dock. They got to try on that, because a lot of people would love to play all these games on. Let's put it this way. If you can somehow get a Turbo graphics FPG on here and then use this on a TV, that would eliminate the need almost for another, you know, a separate console.
Basically. That's what I was talking about earlier. Yeah. That's, yeah. I brought
right. No, but yeah.
I mean, yes, that's exactly it.
But I guess you got to attach a second controller somehow through the console.
It already said the dock will let you do two wired or
Where's
two.
Where's the dock on this page? I don't see it. Oh, there it is.
It'll let you do two wired
oh, there it is.
Or
the dock.
Two wireless controllers.
Oh, the 8-bit 2 controllers are nice, the Bluetooth ones.
It's like they thought of everything.
They thought of everything. That's not going to be $100, and it can't be $100 for that.
Watch it. Watch it be 100.
All right, Surly Ian. Okay. All right. Well, I guess moving on.
And we're back.
Here we are.
Ian, you were so excited.
I was very excited. I said a lot of good things. I think
you said a lot of good things.
I think you probably said a lot of good things too. From what I remember,
you can barely hear my voice. Then,
from what I remember, yep. But there we go.
Also, at PRGE, Ian, we spoke about the Internet Archive adding 2,500 more DOS games to their playable database. We all love DOS games. And you get to hear Pat talk about his childhood story about Donkey. On DOS. So we're going to transfer to that talk now.
The good old Internet Archive, Ian. Hard at work archiving our digital lives. They've just added 2,500 more DOS games to their playable database.
What's that take it up to?
I don't know. Let's find out. They had 2,400 from 2015, so I guess that brings it closer to 5,000. So that's incredible.
That's absurd, but it's great to see it all up there, especially easily accessible in one spot.
And you can play them through whatever the browser. That's great. Because a lot of times, you know, a DOS box is hard to configure. So if they pre-configure it in the browser for each individual game, that's like most of the work done for you at that point. And the big thing about DOS games is that some of these are so archaic and weird. Let's go to the actual announcement here. Like some of these you'll never see or have heard of again for some of these. Let's see. IBM DOS version of Adventure called Microsoft Adventure. A small rebranding of the original start of the Tex Adventure world, Colossal Cave or Avid. I didn't know there was a version of that. How would you like where would you come across that ever again? Something like that. You know what I mean? Like this is really weird stuff that a lot of this stuff's not going to be for sale ever again. You're not going to find it in collections, you know, like official re-releases. So some of this, you know, you have to archive some of this. This isn't like people, you know, selling a bunch of Super Nintendo ROMs and putting it in your Super Nintendo Classic. No, that most of those games are readily available. You can find them. You can buy them in some form. You can buy them here. These are games you cannot. Super Muntrus, the challenge continues. All right. Here you go. 1983, Digger. I played this as a kid. My dad had the 5 1/4s he'd bring home from work. This is a game that it's kind of like a Dig Dug clone, but it's like original. Mm-hmm. And that's a game that I'm sure who actually heard of this game before with its CGA graphics. Three people, four. I'm surprised. But the point is that if you don't archive stuff like this, like I'm not even sure I could find this like an official version of this.
No, probably not.
I mean, and that's what I mean about DOS games being in their sort of weird space outside of other game collecting and preservation. We were up in the past about the DOS Preservation Project, trying to archive not just every DOS game but every DOS utility program and things like that. And they have a list of ones they haven't even found to dump that they know exist but they can't find them. So this is fantastic. I mean, I should spend a weekend. I should become a Twitch streamer of these games and do that. That would be fantastic to do that.
So a DOS game, there was one DOS game that for like a month of my life when I was about 6 or 7, I wanted to be a truck driver.
What?
Yeah.
The open road, Ian.
So my dad and I would browse the local BBSs for... games to download, shareware. Oh. You know, you'd sit there and you'd wait 2 hours to get onto the BBS, and then you would go through the archives and see all the games, and then you would wait, you know, 8 years to download something.
That was like 10 kilobytes.
And there was a game called Big Rigs. And I was like, boy, that sounds good. I don't know why. I was never interested in trucks as a kid, but I wanted to play Big Rigs. So my dad downloaded it, and it took forever. And it was a horrible text adventure trucking game.
Well... That sounds oddly familiar.
But I really, like, it was one of those things where, you know how, like, you get something for Christmas and it might not have been what you wanted or a gift for your birthday, but you play what you have when you're a kid. So I tried to make the best of this truck driving game and got really into it. I learned about like retreads and, you know, the difference between buying some retreaded tires or some fresh tires. Anyway, DOS gaming is really important.
Was it like the text version of the Lemonade game? Like, for
sort of. It was like, do you want to keep driving in a straight line? Yes, let's keep driving. Do you want to keep driving some more? I do want to keep driving some more. Do you want to stop at the rest stop? I'd prefer to just keep on trucking. So, yeah, it was fantastic. Anyways, I didn't become a truck driver. I'm doing this with you.
Did it include any of those, the CD truck stop little adventures?
I'm just here with you.
Okay.
Trucking along.
A little more famously than that is the early Donkey game. So there's a game called Donkey. So on the disc that my dad would pirate, sorry, Dad, the FBI is going to come and get you, that has some of these games on it. It had like a Digger. It had a clone of Q-Bert called Jaybird. Anyone want to hear that one? It literally changed around all the sprites. There is a game called Donkey. It was a basic game. You had to load up basic to play it. So I'm excited because I'm 5 years old. This is Donkey Kong. You load it up. It's a overhead racer game. You have a car. You hit left or right, go back and forth. And the object is not to hit donkeys in the road. You hit a donkey, the donkey explodes. And I was famously coded by Bill Gates like back in like 1980 or so. You know, like an early DOS thing he coded. But that was Donkey.
It's a real bait and switch.
It was a bait and switch when you're 5 and it's free. You got to learn how to read, how to load up in basic, because my dad wasn't going to do it, you know. It was interesting. So the world of DOS games is incredible. And we're not even getting to, like, the CD-ROM era, you know. We're not getting to, like, that weird area in, like, the late 80s, early 90s when consoles didn't come close to the computer in terms of not just how games looked and felt, but, like, the variety of genres they could do. Like, they couldn't do platformers, but they could do adventure games better, do strategy games better, and do simulations better. So there's a lot of jewels out there and gems that you can get lost in it. So yeah, check out the Internet Archive, you know, before someone shuts them down. Like, but I guess no one's going after them for this stuff because like this is a lot of this stuff is, you know, that weird term abandonware when no one's thought about these games for like decades. You know, I should buy the rights to Digger. I think I should do that. Get donkey rights from Bill Gates.
Get donkey rights from Bill Gates sounds extremely shady. Like, that could be any number of things going on.
Donkey rights, that's our code word for that?
Yeah, I got his donkey rights in my back pocket.
Whoa, okay. Make sure it stays there.
And we are back.
Convoy,
that's right.
Move them out.
Donkey and convoy talk. I hope you enjoyed that.
Did I tell you that someone found Big Rig?
Yes, they found it online.
They found it online for me because their kid wanted to play it for some reason after.
Go out and find Donkey. Play Donkey.
Our friend Gates John. So.
All right, Ian, we haven't talked about a top video game list in a while.
We haven't.
It's been a while.
God damn it, stop
it. My voice is back enough to do that. So, IGN just put out a top 100 video games of all time list. It doesn't seem like it's like a user submission because there's like a graphic on it. It's by Justin Davis. I learned to this on Twitter by our pal Norm, the gaming historian. And the first thing that Norm noted was that the release date for Super Mario Bros. 3 was 1998. So he took a little jab on it. It probably meant 88 because 88 is the year.
Yeah.
I believe it came out in Japan. And it was a year later. Was it a year later here?
Year and a half.
Here. Well, it was early 90 here, right?
Yeah.
It was Easter. You know why I knew it was Easter? Because my dumb cousin Chris got it for Easter and I didn't.
Your cousin's real dumb.
Yeah. Anyway.
What a dumb cousin.
Anyway. So, did you go through this list, Ian?
I did. And honestly, I mean, there's weird entries everywhere. But
we can run through it quick.
Yeah, I'll start walking through some of these. So, the list, we've got Pokemon Go at 100. Which, honestly, at some point, I'm not going to find Pokemon Go being on a list being all that weird. Borderlands 2, Divinity. See, the lower portions of these lists never really do a whole lot for me because it's so nebulous, and I think that's where people just like to throw a lot of stuff in there that they think deserves recognition, but not necessarily, ranks somewhere. It's when you get to, like, the top 25, the top 35 that I start to... judge the choices a bit more harshly.
Here's the thing. it's hard to say what's the best game of all time. Is it the best? Is it the most influential? Is it historically significant? Is it the best of its genre? You know, like, or the greatest example of genre? To me, you have to combine all those elements in. You know, so something like Tecmo Super Bowl should be on the top 100 list. Doesn't, I don't care, it's a sports game. It's was one of the best sports games of this generation, and people still play it today and update it. For me alone, a game like that should be on the top 100. A game like GTA 3 should be on the list because it's so influential in terms of the open world, and that sort of created the formula for open world games going forward. Legend of Zelda should be on the top 100 list just because. You know, like things like that. Pac-Man, you can argue, can make the list because it exploded arcades. So there's different criteria to add, you know, to put on the list. So just be consistent, though, on what your list is. So my problem before we go through these is that, like, 80% of these games were made within the past 15 years in this list.
Sure.
And that just shows a lack of knowing the history of video games. And that's a mistake. And that goes along a line of not just ignoring the past, but that means, what, any new game that comes out that's great, you're going to have to bump up an older game from the list just to make a new one. And that's what they even explained themselves in IGN. They did a rundown of their changes to this list. Like, Ocarina of Time was bumped out of the top 10. Breath of the Wild was added to the top 10. They swapped Portal and Portal 2. The placement of Halo and Halo 2 was swapped. God of War 2019 was added. Smash Melee was swapped out for Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. So right there, it's like, well, if Melee was great, it should still be in the list, not swapped out entirely for a game that's a newer version of it. I don't get that at all. I mean, personally, I don't. That's like saying, well, we'll swap out Super Mario 3 for a newer Super Mario game. It's like, no, yeah, it's still great.
You don't necessarily... Yeah, I don't agree with the swapping out. If Melee... And I don't like Melee, but if Melee stands on its own merits,
yeah,
the new version is not always a better, shinier version of the game. There's differences. There's things that change between them. There's reasons why people liked Melee. Melee didn't need to be changed or reassessed because it's old and now Ultimate is out. It just needed to be... I mean, there just needed to be an assessment of where it should be on the list. Just because Ultimate would be on the list doesn't mean that Melee couldn't be.
They said then, why? How did they choose it? So people was like, Ultimate over Melee? This is them writing, no more Wind Waker. We try to make room for more franchises, capture our staff's loud opinions, and focus more on the best games rather than the most influential ones. That's a separate list we're planning to make soon.
Okay. I mean, that's fair. I do think there is something to be said about having a difference between influential and best.
But then if you focus on best, by even their standards here, this is why we have for the newer version, there'll be less and less older games on this list they don't consider best, just because they think, I guess, to me, inherently, they think the quality of the newer games are better than the old ones because they have better graphics, even in the old franchise. Like, we swapped out, they're adding newer versions of, what was the one I just saw? They swapped out like a Fallout for the Fallout 3 was swapped out for Fallout New Vegas. So we'll just keep updating.
Wait, Fallout what?
Fallout 3 was swapped out for Fallout New Vegas.
Well, I mean, honestly, depending on when the list was, I feel like that's a reasonable swap.
They removed Grim Fandango. They removed Metal Gear Solid 2. They removed Team Fortress 2. They removed Warcraft 2. They removed Oregon Trail. They removed, so they're getting some of these influential games out of there.
Well, I mean, but then again, it's also...
Warcraft 2 not being... Warcraft 2 is a... God, that's a...
Getting rid of some of these games, though, I mean, it doesn't mean that the original list was right and this one is now wrong.
Some of these
things need to be reassessed.
But let's go through it then. I'll just run through them. Super Mario Bros. 3 at 100. Okay, that's almost
that's not at 100. That's at 6. It's the way the list is done. It's weird.
Oh, it's done weird? They put 6 first?
No, it was because I followed the link for 6, and now if you just start scrolling down, it goes from 100 to 1.
Pokemon Go, 100. Okay, Borderlands 2. Divinity Original Sin 2. These are all within the past 10 years. Dishonored, 2012. Final Fantasy 7, the original, at 96. Okay.
See, now that's an interesting drop. And I think that's an interesting one to me because, I mean, for years that game was constantly in top 25s. And
yeah, I was
saying
top 25, top 30s.
But, I mean, I think it's fair, too. As time has gone on, you know, and people have looked at it differently and the hype has died down and other better RPGs have come out, I can see where, you know, in a 20-year time span, something like Final Fantasy VII would no longer be held in that regard. And that's fine.
Okay. I'm going to count the games before 2000, by the way, as we go through this. So far, we have none. Right? We have none so far until this one. That's one.
I was going to say Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, it's one. Okay, Assassin's Creed 4, Black Flag. I don't know anything about that game at all, or Assassin's Creed games. Monkey Island 2, LeChuck's Revenge. Okay, Ian, you're a fan of that series?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Burnout 3 Takedown from 2004. You know anything about the Burnout series?
Yeah, it's a really good game. I mean, none of these games are necessarily... I'd say Burnout should be on there.
Undertale, that's the indie darling on here. League of Legends, okay. That's from Hollywood. Mega Man 3, that's what we wanted to see. You usually see Mega Man 2, not Mega Man 3.
It seems like it's a 50-50 split between people.
Okay, Mega Man 3 took every lesson from Mega Man 2 and expanded, refined, remixed it. So already they're updating the newer version of it. Soul Calibur absolutely deserves to be in the top 100, I would say. If you have to limit to like 3 or 4 fighting games, that should be there. Thief 2 the Middle Age, that's a weird one, just because I never heard that one being as well regarded as the first one back in the day, and I thought that Thief 2 was buggy. I remember playing Thief 1, I played Thief 2, I never heard of that one being the one. SimCity 2000, absolutely. SimCity 2000 was a great game, really expanded and defined the mold of the series going forward. Inside from 2016, I've never heard of that. Inside,
it's a great game. It's weird that it's on the list though.
Contra. Now here's the thing, Ian. I'm not sure Contra makes the top 100 list, and I love Contra. I don't know if that deserves to be on the list or not.
Oh, I think it does.
I'm just saying I don't think it. Maybe or barely makes it.
That game is a fucking masterclass in control tuning.
I'm not saying it's not one of the best running shooters, but I guess I would maybe put it in the 90s then, and I love it. Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 2. I don't know much about that series, but I hear that's like, yeah, it's fantastic for a skating game. I have to add one more to the top before 2000. Monster Hunter World from 2018. It's almost like too soon to put these on the top 100 list. They're too new, some of these.
I mean, it was incredibly well reviewed. The expansion came out. It's been incredibly well reviewed. I think it is probably one of the best online games I've played.
Resident Evil 2, the remake, which just came out. System Shock 2.
That's actually, I like that.
89. Grand Theft Auto Vice City. See, putting that and not GTA 3.
See, I'm surprised they didn't put San Andreas. So at that point, it just comes down to personal opinion.
Okay. That's from 2002. Persona 5 came out a couple years ago.
See, now that's an instance where I'd argue they chose that one because it's the latest and greatest. It's a good game, but I think there's arguments that it could be any number of Personas.
Our favorite Battle Royale game, Fortnite's at 77. Okay. Fable 2.
Deserved. I'd hate to say it, but deserved.
GoldenEye. Would you put GoldenEye in your top 100? I would not.
I think that deserves to be somewhere on influential because as far as a console game, it was very, I mean, it wasn't influential necessarily in terms of FPS, but it was very influential on consoles.
Sure.
I mean, after that, you saw everything trying to do some battle royale modes, but as a great game, no, even the people who come into the store and buy it all the time now are like, hey, it's not so much fun anymore.
If that's on this list and not Wolfenstein, I will throw something.
Well, Wolfenstein definitely shouldn't be, and neither should that.
Well, I would say Wolfenstein 3D makes the list before GoldenEye does.
No, neither of them make the list because they're not fun to play. These are top 100 games.
Wolfenstein, okay, we have a different disagreement. What should
Doom
make the list.
Should be on here. That not
versus Wolfenstein?
Yes, versus okay. Wolfenstein.
Smash Brothers Ultimate, okay, they swapped out Melee. Okay. Elder Scrolls 5, Skyrim, people love that game. Yeah, XCOM, UFO Defense. There's a lot of strategy games and stuff like that already making the list for the older PCs of no other genre. That's interesting to me. That's really interesting to me. Suikoden 2 from, what was that, 99? Okay. Battlefield 1942. Okay. That's an important game. I'm not sure that makes the list, but I mean, I played that. That was important for, like, massive multiplayer battle at the time, but that's an interesting one to me. Because that, to me, is be more influential than being a great game, at least to me. That makes the list. Dota 2, no, anything about those are MOBAs. I know nothing about those. Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. So I guess if you're gonna pick one Mario Kart game, I guess you would do that.
I do actually. I've made that argument with people before. I've said it. Mario Kart 8 Deluxe to me is just about the perfect Mario Kart,
and or just
it
regular
has,
8
it
was
has,
great.
And
yeah.
It has rendered almost all prior
was
versions
useless.
Of it useless. I know people love Double Dash, and I think people are getting over 64 to a point, but people love 64. But honestly, it would be hard for me to argue that 8 Deluxe is not the best one.
Gotcha.
It's just got everything you could possibly want in it.
Okay. Sorry, I'm getting my counter wrong on the post. Star Wars Jedi Knight 2, Jedi Outcast. I never played it. I do know that I remember there was a lot of PC lists, like best PC gaming lists in the late 90s that cited Jedi Knight, the original, Dark Force 2, as one of the top 5 PC games ever at the time. And obviously, it's an important series. Spelunky from 2012.
Yes, it belongs on there.
See, that's what I mean, Ian. So now we got Donkey Kong. Donkey Kong is a fun game, but is it most influential or greatest? Because Donkey Kong Jr. to me is a better game than Donkey Kong. It just is. In terms of mechanics, in terms of what you can do, in terms of variety of gameplay. So that's what I mean. This list is already kind of weird to me. It doesn't abide by its own rules. The Sims, sure, why not? Is the first one better than the later ones? I don't know. Rock Band's on here, okay. Red Dead Redemption 2, people love it. Splinter Cell Chaos Theory, I know nothing about
bizarre.
The Splinter Cell series.
Bizarre, bizarre choice. Yeah, that's a weird one. That's kind of out of nowhere.
Yoshi's Island, 5 stars according to a certain Super Nintendo guidebook that deserves it. It's a great game. Silent Hill 2.
There.
Is that worth it?
Yep, I would say so. Honestly, I'm going to be honest with you. As we go up this list, I went through it, and I just couldn't get as angry about the choices as I think
everyone
else did.
Let's go to the top 10, through this.
Because San Andreas is at 58. I'll run through the top. Let's see. Let me hit 25 here.
Miss Pac-Man's at 47.
That's what I'm saying, though. Like, those bottom levels, that bottom 50 of any of these lists is always going to be a messy thing. Here's an interesting placement, and I don't necessarily disagree, but Earthbound at 44, I have a feeling, probably pissed off some people.
Too high or too low for you?
For me, no real opinion. For a lot of people, I'm certain that's going to be far too low.
Yeah, but there's people that overly love that game. Is it influence versus the best, or is it just people thought it was quirky?
All right, Metal Gear Solid, 30. God of War, the new one, 29. The Witcher 3, Wild Hunt, 28. People love that game. Bioshock, 27. Sid Meier's Civilization 4.
You need a Civilization on here.
You do. And I think 4 is a real solid pick if you're going to pick one. I really like 6, but 4 was phenomenal. I played 4 forever. I passed over 5. I did 4 forever. Ocarina of Time at 25. I think that's about right. Ocarina of Time is, I mean, as time... Age exposes some things, and I think it makes people more willing to drop some of these once long held up icons of, you know, greatest games, because that's another one along with Final Fantasy VII that used to always be in the top 10.
All right, let's pick it up.
Minecraft. Halo Combat Evolved, Half-Life.
Okay. That should be almost higher to me, but
Metal Gear Solid 3 Snake Eater, Last of Us, Doom.
Doom at 19, okay.
It should be, and I'm happy about
that. Was it influential or good? I mean, that's
good. That's the thing. People and people who go back and play Doom are always like, wow, it's still surprisingly good. Okay. It's a fun game.
Chrono Trigger,
Portal, Dark Souls, Street Fighter 2, Super Mario Brothers.
See, that's the thing, though. Street Fighter 2, there's a post-Street Fighter games.
See, that to me is like, that's a weird non-swap. That should be influential, and I feel like something like Super Turbo should be, if you want,
higher.
Higher.
Or Championship should be higher, even.
Halo 2.
Same with Super Mario Brothers. You know, if you're going to put that on the list, like, Super Mario 3 would be higher if you're talking about actual gameplay.
It is.
Oh, that's right.
It's at 6. Castlevania Symphony of the Night at 12. Grand Theft Auto 5 at 11. Super Mario 64 at 10.
The first Red Dead Redemption at 9, okay. Having that end the second one on the
Half-Life
list?
Half-Life 2, Tetris at 7, Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild at 5, Super Metroid at 4, Portal 2 at 3.
Portal and Portal 2 on the list, okay.
That's like me putting Alien and Aliens in my top 5 movies. Legend of Zelda Link to the Past.
Weird fucking list.
And Super Mario World is the number one.
What a bizarre list.
So, like,
it's fucking bizarre.
From 40 to, like, 15, everything kind of comes back together in a way where I'm like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, but
and then it ends it just kind of, like, throwing the hot hits
but
and seeing where they land.
Your top 10 has, like, 7 Nintendo titles, which is weird. That's just weird to me. It's like no more PC stuff anymore with Half-Life 2. It's a weird list. It's not consistent.
I was expecting to hate this list more than I do.
No, I hate it more now. I see the top. And these games that should be in the list, the order is all wacky as fuck on this stuff. You think Link to the Past is the second best game of all time?
No. But a list is never going to be perfect, and it's never going to appeal to everyone.
It's weird.
Time is passing me by, and I'm getting older, and I just don't care. I have problems with the construction of the list and the fact that it doesn't seem like it abides by its own rules. I can't get that.
I'm not that
upset
I'm just
about
saying,
ranking,
but IGN is a huge video game website, and when you have your 3 Super Nintendo games in the top 4. That's not a consistent list. And that's not to say they don't belong in the top 20 or top 30 or top 40. It's just inconsistent and it's sloppy. Because then you jump and then there's like no Super Nintendo until you like get the Chrono Trigger.
Playing as a devil's advocate who doesn't like the Super Nintendo here, maybe the Super Nintendo was just a really good system that had a lot of great games on
it. I'm shocked you have not pointed out, Ian, that there is like almost there's no Sega titles on this list at all.
No, I know. I've noticed that. There's like nothing.
If you want to count, Soul Calibur is Namco. But I mean, like, there's no Genesis games. There's no Saturn games.
The construction of the list is problematic in that it
barely any arcade.
It
games.
Looks at basically it looks at the past 10 years of modern games
and overweights them.
It looks at the past 10 years of modern games. And then it goes down the quick who's who of retro games.
Yes, without having any real knowledge or breadth. And there's barely any older PC games in the list either. So anyway, all right, well, it is what it is. We're disappointed. And then people pointed out before that it was so sloppy just in the editorial that when they swapped out games, they didn't swap out the text. So you would say, like, choice number 74, and then the game description was the old game that used to be in that spot. It was just, like, sort of sloppy editorial. But whatever, that's neither here nor there. All right, moving on. All right, Ian... we talked about gaming disorder being put, being recognized universally. Now there's an update on the story here.
So the study finds insufficient evidence of gaming as a clinical disorder. And this is something Pat and I have talked about before. And the study essentially says what we always kind of thought and talked about on here. There's no compelling evidence to warrant classifying gaming as a clinical disorder in its own right. It goes on to essentially say that, you know, this is a symptom of a larger problem, not the problem itself. According to research conducted by Oxford University in partnership with Cardiff University, there's nothing clinically wrong with obsessive gamers. Rather than being negatively impacted by gaming itself, it's suggested that young people who engage in dysfunctional gaming may be doing so in a bid to escape underlying frustrations and wider psychosocial functioning issues. Now, this is an article by posted on Video Games Chronicle, written by... I just want to give credit where I can. Tom Ivan. And that's exactly what we've been saying. There are larger problems that cause people to seek out something to escape that problem.
Yeah.
Whether and there are healthy ways of doing it and unhealthy ways of doing it, and a lot of times hobbies become it. I read for the majority of my youth to get away from other social issues I didn't want to deal with. Lots of people play games for doing it too.
Sure.
It's not the game that is literally the disorder. You know, there's no. I don't think there's a reading disorder. Yet there are bookworms who do the exact same thing that people who play games do, but they just they sit in a library and they read all day.
Suggested that young people who engage in dysfunctional gaming, I like that term, dysfunctional gaming, maybe doing so in a bid to escape underlying frustrations and wider psychosocial functioning issues. It involved collecting and analyzing data from 1,000 adolescents. That's a good pool, good sample size, and an equal number of caregivers in England, Scotland, and Wales. The adolescents completed questionnaires about their gaming behavior while caregivers rated their child's emotional and social health. That sounds like it's pretty good. Pretty good. Jesus Christ, I can't think of it. God, my mind's going blank. Structure for doing the study.
Sure.
Methodology. God, I did studies in college. Jeez. They found most adolescents played at least one online game daily. Less than half of daily players reported symptoms of obsessive gaming. Less than half. And daily players, a typo, spend an average of 3 hours gaming each day. Professor Andrew Prisbilski, director of research at the Oxford Internet Institute, said the World Health Organization and the American Psychiatric Association have called on researchers to investigate the clinical relevance of dysregulated video gaming among adolescents. I like that term too, dysregulated. As previous studies have failed to examine the wider context of what is going on in these young people's lives. So they're doing the work that we talked about. It's like, well, these kids might have something else going on, either at school, maybe they're getting bullied, maybe they just have anxiety in general, and gaming fulfills something for them or takes them away from it, or, you know, or maybe they have another issue that the gaming might feed into. But like you said, in itself, the gaming itself is not forming these issues in these children and adolescents. It just isn't. It can't.
So, I mean, it's good to read that, but now hopefully focus will... I always kind of cringe when focus is way too much on video games, and there's... Everyone wants to wring their hands over video games. No one wants to wring their hands over the issues that surround the reasons why video games get into the news, such as violence and obsessive gaming and things like that. So, I don't know. I would love to see it move on to, you know, a study that could be helpful as opposed to constantly trying to pin everything on the game itself.
So this is the key takeaway. Our findings provided no evidence suggesting an unhealthy relationship with gaming accounts for substantial emotional, peer, and behavioral problems. Instead, variations in gaming experience are much more likely to be linked to whether adolescents' basic psychological needs for competence, autonomy, and social belonging are being met, and if they are already experiencing wider functioning issues. In light of our findings, we do not believe sufficient evidence exists to warrant thinking about gaming as a clinical disorder in its own right. So if that child is playing games for 15, 20 hours a day, won't come to dinner, won't go out and you know, function, you know, with his friends socially, it's not because of the game, it's because of issues before the game got there.
Right.
The game, yeah. Now, here's what I'm going to say, though. It doesn't help that the game's there, because then it becomes like a cocoon of experience where now I'm safe, I won't try to get out of this safe spot.
Yes,
but that's something for the adults to manage, though.
Yeah, and that can be, like, yeah. I said, that can be said about any number of other things people escape into. It's someone who sits in their room and obsessively plays their guitar all day, or reads all day, or plays games all day. None of these things are unhealthy on their own. As a matter of fact, in a lot of ways, these things are great. It's how
things become too healthy when it takes over your activities and, you know, your daily life. And
correct.
Yeah, that's what happens. And say there takes precedence over the blah, 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 blah. Okay, that's fine. Neuroscientist Nastasia Griffion, is that a letter? It's a weird letter. Recently warned of the dangers of stigmatizing people as being addicted to video games. If we do stigmatize people basically as being addicted to video games, we might take away those video games when they might be a coping mechanism for a deeper underlying problem like depression or anxiety, she said. All right, well, there you have it. It's what we basically said before. Not that me and Ian are clinical psychologists, but to me it was always, well, I took psychology, but it was always common sense that, you know, the gaming itself, because there's also a huge variety in the gaming experience as well. So it's like, well, if this person is addicted to playing World of Warcraft, that's different than someone else being addicted to a puzzle game or whatever else. They might fulfill different functions to that person. You know, a feeling of community versus just having a quick 5-10 minute game, or me playing poker for 10-20 minutes as an escape. You know, it's different. You can't lump it all together either way. So, all right, moving on. Ian, we have a Patreon poll topic. And how do you access our Patreon?
Patreon.com/CU podcast and marvel at all that we will offer you.
Ian's got to do a writing. Did you do one this week, Ian? Uh-huh. In Portland, you didn't?
No.
All right.
I'm letting myself slide on that one because Portland was a mess. But I will have a good mess, but I will have a writing up shortly this week.
Okay. So, wow, this is a three-way split in the 30s. Ooh. We're getting better at doing these topics. In third place, at 31%, what pinball arcade games would be your dream arcade? It pumped back up the list.
Pump.
32%, second place, what's the dream convention panel you want to see? And in first place, 37%, favorite board games. Ian, take it away. Ian, what are some of your favorite
board
games? Holy
shit, I thought that we were going to... I thought for certain the panel one was a guaranteed pick.
You don't know the will of the patrons.
So I do like to play a lot of board games, but the ones that I think that I always go back to that are classics for me, I cannot get enough Scrabble, and I will play Othello at any time of the day.
What do you like about Scrabble?
So I grew up playing Scrabble. I remember it's like one of the first board games I remember learning how to play, which is funny because obviously it requires quite a bit more thought than a kid is going to have. But I remember, you know, it's always been a big game on my mom's side of the family, big extended family over there. And holiday get-togethers were always, you know, there was at least a couple Scrabble boards out and people would be playing. And being young, I, of course, took an interest in what you know, my family was doing. So my mom would, you know, slowly from a very early age was telling me how to, you know, play the game and put words together. And I like it because it's not only like a game to stretch your brain and kind of work on vocabulary and stuff like that, but it's a strategy game. And so few people who don't play a lot of Scrabble don't realize that it's a fucking board control strategy game.
You got it.
Like it's words, but it's a war out there on that board too. It's all about setting up your position so you can make your attack for later. And, you know, sometimes making that two-letter word that doesn't look like, you know, anything is what you need to do because you've got a plan in your head. You've got something that you're setting up. So it's a spelling game. And at the base of it, people are like, oh, that's quaint. But it's also a vicious battle for board control. And I fucking love that about Scrabble. It's so good. Good Scrabble is so good. Anyway, yeah, sorry.
Are you a Monopoly fan at all?
No, I hate Monopoly.
I used to be a Monopoly fan. And then it's funny because it was created to show the bad sides of capitalism. and people tearing each other apart. And that's what the game ends up usually.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, it's just fun. We had the Cheerios giveaway 50th anniversary version from like 85, where they came back with the wooden pieces for the first time in the middle.
Yeah,
because they didn't do that for a while. And we played a lot. We loved it. I loved the game Ghost. It was a Milton Bradley game, I believe. I don't think it was Parker Brothers, where it was like a strategy game. They glow in the dark pieces. You had like about 12 pieces each, and you had good pieces and bad pieces. So the object, and you can't see what pieces you have versus your opponent because the dots are on their side.
It was like Stratego.
Green and red pieces. So the idea was to capture the evil ghost, but not the bad ghost. The evil ghost, but not the good ghost. If you captured too many good ghosts, you lost. At the same time, your good ghost could try to escape out the sides. So it was a gambit whether or not you think your opponent's bluffing. Maybe they're sending an evil ghost down that you want to capture, or it's a good go. So you don't know what you're capturing. It's like a total crapshoot, but there is a little strategy involved. And I'd love to play it again today, because as a kid with my sister, I probably didn't know the intricacies of the strategy that were involved.
Yep. I had it too. I remember getting that game from a flea market when I was younger, and I freaking loved it. That game was a lot of fun. I liked some of those blind, like, bluffing type games like that. Yeah. Like, I haven't played it like at all.
It was called Ghost. It was Milton Bradley.
I looked it up. It's a nice looking game too.
Yeah, it's just a cool layout, and it's you know, not too complex. Now, in terms of complexity, if you go Mousetrap, I still like Mousetrap, and people don't understand that you were supposed to build it as you went. Right, you land there. You don't build it all, but people just like to build it. They probably still make Mousetrap.
They do.
It's brilliant.
Oh, they'll never stop making that.
And it didn't break. I never had a break either. It always worked. Like, the pieces were sturdy, at least back in the day. Even, you know, the old timey man taking the dive in the tub, things like that.
So if you liked Ghosts, did you ever play Stratego?
I think I did, but I was too young to understand it. I probably would. It's sort of similar. You're supposed to not capture certain pieces.
It's more complicated than Ghosts, but it's still all about like blind bluffing and stuff like that.
Okay, it's about blind bluffing.
Yeah.
I never played Risk. That should be a game I should be playing. That sounds like a fun game. Or Axis and Allies, which is kind of like that, more complex.
I love Risk.
I think I have it from the swap meet.
Whenever we go, John and I play a lot of Risk. Used to play a lot of Risk, and we play it all the way through. We're one of those groups that, like, when we settle in for a game of Risk, we're rolling to the very end.
You're rolling deep?
Rolling deep. Like, yeah, there's no shortcuts or anything like that. The last time I played a full five-player game, it was Vani, myself, John, and two of my other friends, my friend Chris and my friend Alex, and it was a four-hour game. And Vani came in second place, and she refused to succeed, or she refused to surrender. They rolled every last die until she was completely wiped out of troops. She made John work for that victory.
All right, I respect that war of attrition. And then, of course, I mean, I love chess. Ian talks about times.
I love chess too.
I played chess in high school. I was an overachiever, a lazy overachiever at chess in high school. I think I told a story a couple times. I won't get into it now, but I did better than I should have with no training. And I really think I should have committed myself to it and learned openings and strategies. I think I could have done something with it. And I still enjoy it.
Did you ever play backgammon?
I never got into backgammon.
I've been getting into backgammon lately again. It's stupid fun.
Yeah, good strategy
It's a lot of fun. A lot of good strategy.
We had the board. You had the little shakers.
Yeah.
The little cool little dice shakers with that. Then I regard the backgammon. All right. Any other ones? We'll have time for a Q&A, but any other ones you want to discuss that are true to your heart?
I'm good. We can move on.
Monopoly, Mousetrap, Dizzy Dinosaur was great.
Oh, I had the block. That. Yeah, I had Dizzy Dinosaur.
It was all about the toys. And see, here's the thing about board games now. Board games now are about like tabletop and being ultra-ly, you know, or simulating something, or you know all these rules. Back in the 80s, And early 90s, it was all just like toys and, you know, Volcano Mountain and wiping your little toys out and Dizzy Dinosaur. Things like that's how the board games were to draw you in. I'm sure they still make it, but not like how they used to.
Sure.
You know, those commercials are great. Now I want to do like a 4-hour block of like watching old board game commercials. Like Party. Pizza Party. Hey, everybody, there's a brand new game.
It's just
Pizza
memory.
Party. That's the name. Sorry. Okay. Moving on. All right, Ian, which Q&A do you want to do there out of the two?
I have to go. It's 10:32.
I thought you had until 10:40.
Well, all right. Quickly then, what Q&A are we going to do?
You want to do the Goose Game one?
Yeah, we'll do the Goose Game.
All right, this is from that unnecessary fan. Untitled Goose Game is still at number one spot in Nintendo Switch eShop as of this tweet. What makes it indie games like it so popular and successful?
I think... So there's a number of reasons why the Goose Game is doing well. It's fantastic. It's not like... it's not my favorite game that's come out recently, but that's not a negative to it. But if you play indie games, you've played things that probably remind you of it. One that reminds me of it in a way that came out recently was Donut County. Games like this tend to...
Donut County.
Games like this tend to, I think, especially like the Goose game, their popularity rests on three things that they've done very well. A sense of humor, like a great sense of humor, mm-hmm. a welcoming art style, and the ability to kind of create mischief and be a jerk, but not a huge jerk. And
not a huge enough jerk, but a jerk.
But that's also, I think, why Donut County succeeded in a way too.
I'm looking at Donut County.
So
right now.
In Donut County, you play as well, kind of a donut, but it's a story about a raccoon and a girl. And the raccoon's an asshole.
Oh, I've heard this game. Okay.
I've played through it on stream twice. I freaking love it. And you play as, it's the story about this raccoon and this girl, and it's the story about how the raccoon sends out these donuts and causes havoc throughout the town. And it's got a very nice, like, sense of, like, a laid-back sense of humor, a pleasing art style. And I'm not saying that Goose Game copied it. I'm saying that these are just things that exist that really bring people together. So the Goose Game is the same thing. It's nice. It's approachable. And it's...
I like how you said approachable. I think that's very important.
It's very approachable. And while it's not an easy game, like figuring out some of the puzzles will take you some time, it's fun enough in that I'm creating havoc and being a jerk sort of way. While you're trying to figure out what you're doing, even if you're not checking the items off the list, you're still being a goose that's turning on a faucet and then running away. And
stealing
then,
glasses
and then
something.
Stealing yeah. the keys from the janitor. Yeah. And like it's very
it's
fun. And it's genuinely funny. It's a genuinely funny game. It's a great idea to play an annoying goose. You tell someone that there's a game where you can be an annoying goose, they're going to want to mess with it for even 5 minutes.
I think people are clamoring for more variety than we give them credit for. And that goes with movies, too. That's why Scorsese was complaining about all the Marvel films. And their point is not lost on me, even though they might go over the top, is that if you give people more variety, you'd be surprised at how often they'll jump towards it.
Yes.
And try it out. And for something like this Donut County or Untitled Goose Game, people are just like overwhelmed by the fact that, oh my God, this is different than anything else I've seen.
Right.
This isn't just like Frank would say, a game where you walk around the corner and shoot someone in the face. There's millions of those games. They're not inviting, like you said. They're not original. This is something you haven't seen before. It's something inventive. It's something cute. And it's something that you won't forget. You'll forget playing about that first person shooter in 2 months. Or even an average indie platformer. You'll forget about this. This you won't forget about this anytime soon.
In games like those two specifically, I love them because not every game has to be an emotional roller coaster. Not every game has to be violent. Not every game has to tell the story of the end of the world. But at yes, the same sure. on the other end, not every game has to be a Borderlands where it's all fucking yuck yucks and slapstick and dumb jokes. Like you can make something that's genuinely charming and humorous without it beating you over the head.
And the fact that these aren't huge companies making these games, producing these games. There's also a little bit of an underdog to it. Okay, let's help out this little smaller company making this game, and see where it goes, and maybe they do more games. That's part of it, too. But I honestly think that there's an audience that want to play more different variety of games, and they just want... And obviously, they're out there, but they're impossible to find on Steam. And something as well-polished as these games that is recognized by, Sony and by Nintendo, and they're pushed... you see them like in Nintendo Direct, like with the Untitled Goose Game. People are like, oh my God, what is this game? I would never expect a game like this to exist.
Right.
They're out there, but they got to be pushed more. And hopefully we see more and more of this, because you only hear about these games like maybe once or twice, even in a full year. Any games like this that get this popular, it's not often that this happens.
Yeah, no, it's not at all.
So that's it. I got to play the Untitled Goose Game. Should I get it on Switch or should I get it on Steam? What do you think?
I would get it on Switch. It's a nice fit for on the go, because you can pick it up, knock a couple things off your checklist by being a dumb goose, and then go back to your day.
I should get Killer Queen Black, according to Ian. So
yes,
I get that.
You should.
And Ian was clamoring for it.
I was supposed to play that this weekend with Grace, Derek, and Ant, and we never got made time. So maybe I'll stream that later this week.
Oh, advertise it for Ian. Okay. All right, that's it for the CU Podcast. Did we mention the Patreon? Patreon.com/CU Podcast.
Yeah.
CU Podcast. And then go to the Super Nintendo Guide is going to be at the warehouse. Oh, a little moth. It's going to be at the warehouse. Moth's going all over my hand and arm. Later this week, you can pre-order it at ultimatesnes.com and obviously also the NES book. Yeah, and that's it. And I'm going to be at Syracuse for Retro Game Con. It's my last event of the year that I'm aware of. And that is November 2nd and 3rd. And then, yeah, Ian has a video that should be coming out.
Working
eventually.
On videos, yes.
Ian figured out how hard it is to do video
editing. I can do some basic video editing. The problem is for the Krosnick one, by the time I finish it, who knows if it should even go up. But, no, I need to capture two-player gameplay. That's the problem. And the versus picture. Gameplay, there is no AI. The versus gameplay is one-on-one. All so right. I just haven't had time to sit down and capture
sit down
that
with Bonnie
yet.
And do it. There you go.
So.
Or I'll do it with you. You know, I'll help you do your first video. We'll put it on the Patreon. We'll put it on the CU Podcast Patreon, too.
Early. The Patreon? The Patreon?
Or do you have your Patreon still?
Actually, I don't have a Patreon.
You have
have one for Extra Napkins. Check out Extra Napkins, okay, my other podcast. But that's not... Yeah, that's simply for that.
Okay, well, it's up to you where you want to post it. Okay, well, for Ian Ferguson, I am Pat Contry, voice slowly coming back. We will see you in a week...